This is the Paula Gordon Show. We are pleased that Ray Kurzweil is our guest. We're with him here in Boston, loosely speaking, Boston. Boston is one of the most frustrating places I've ever been in my life. I love Boston, but I have just a terrible time getting around in Boston. If I can't get around in Boston, how can all these other magnificent big things happen if we can't fix something as simple as me finding you?
Well, the roads in Boston were originally laid out by the cows.
I believe you. I believe you.
Wherever they wandered, that's where we made
many cows.
And we do have a legacy of decisions that are made from early eras. And
I really don't ask that lightly, because there are lots of things like that.
Well, I think we are seeing a general trend from the real world to the virtual world, and from concentrated technologies like cities and roads towards distributed, decentralized technologies like the Internet. And September 11th has certainly accelerated that movement away from real meetings to virtual meetings, from real postal mail to email, and the whole virtual world, which is safer, much more stable. No one has ever taken the Internet down for even a minute, because it's decentralized. There's no sort of key hub. If you take it down, it would destroy the whole thing. Pieces of it sometimes go down, and the information routes around it. And it's actually biologically inspired. I mean, that's how our brain works. We don't have a chief executive officer neuron. There's no key connection, which if you break, sort of breaks the backbone of all your thinking. None of our neurons or connections are particularly important. We lose thousands of them every day, and it doesn't really matter. It's the whole pattern of information. It's the same thing with the Internet. And we're going to be building technology in this more stable, decentralized, biologically inspired manner, and be moving from these centralized technologies like cities and buildings towards people being able to live where they want, not being so concerned with how the roads are laid out, communicating with anyone they want to at any time through the Internet. Right now, virtual reality is not as realistic as real reality, but that's going to change. And there's other examples of this. We need to move from centralized, dangerous energy technologies like nuclear power plants to relatively safer, decentralized methods like fuel cells.
You raise in your latest book, I think it's your latest book, an interesting issue. We earlier in the week talked with Steve Wise, who's trying to get legal rights, legal personhood for primates, specifically bonobos and chimpanzees. We've got Steve over here trying to bring some of our relatives in under, give them legal protection. And you raise an issue that comes from the opposite side of that, which is the possibility that fairly rapidly, by your accounting, we're going to have creatures, call them something, that are substantially computer-based, or an extension of what we think of as computer-based, that will be in many ways indistinguishable from humans and may in fact be part human. And again, the issue of rights comes up, but in this case, and actually in both cases, those rights issues address some very, very profound issues of how we think of ourselves and also how we adapt to the world around us.
Well, I think the whole issue you're talking about is going to be a real practical, political, legal issue in the 21st century. It's been an issue for the last several thousand years on a philosophical level, starting back with the Platonic dialogues, which debated what is the true nature of consciousness and, you know, is it possible that an entity that's not made of biological neurons could be conscious and so on. But we're actually going to confront this issue in a practical way. There won't be a clear distinction between human and machine by the middle of this century. For example, we are currently reverse engineering the human brain, which is
reverse engineering may not be a readily accessible idea.
Which means understanding how it works and its principles of operation, and then recreating those methods in non-biological methods, i.e., machines. And computers themselves are getting more and more powerful. By 2020, we'll have personal computers that are powerful enough to emulate what the brain does. We won't have the software by then, but by 2030, I believe we will, because we'll have completed our mission to understand how the human brain works, and we'll be able to replicate it. We'll also be extending our biological intelligence through intimate connection with non-biological intelligence. I've talked a lot about a scenario using what I call nanobots, which are nanometer-sized or nanotechnology-based robots, tiny robots the size of blood cells that could travel through the bloodstream, go through the capillaries into the brain, and do a number of things there by interacting non-invasively, no surgery required, with our biological neurons. And the basis for communication between electronics and biological neurons has already been established in animals. And in fact, we already have neural implants for humans. Today, they need to be surgically implanted, and they're generally used for serious medical conditions or disabilities, such as cochlear implants for the deaf and neural implants for Parkinson's disease.
Where we physically go into the brain and we put ways to stimulate parts of the
brain. Right. Actually, this Parkinson's implant is an interesting example because it actually is a little device that replicates what the biological neurons that were destroyed are doing. There's a certain region of the brain that the Parkinson's disease attacks, and we've been able to model what that what those neurons do and create an electronic device that does the same thing, and we place it in the brain of a Parkinson's patient that has those cells destroyed and hook it up with the rest of the biological brain, and it successfully replicates the functionality of those destroyed neurons. And this is an early example, and it's invasive because it requires surgery, but once we can actually send intelligent machines through the bloodstream in little devices the size of blood cells, and those devices then can communicate wirelessly with our biological neuron, the principles of which, or the basis of which has been demonstrated, then we'll be able to actually extend human intelligence ultimately by sending these billions of nanobots. They take up key positions in the brain and actually then create new interneuronal connections, which is where our thinking takes place. And so instead of now being limited, as we are today, to a mere 100 trillion connections, which sounds like a large
number. He smiles.
It sounds like a large number. But
it is bigger than a bread box.
It's also quite limiting. I mean, I'm just thinking about all the books I'd like to read and the websites I'd like to visit and the thoughts that like to be able to explore, and we're all very limited, and we'll be able to actually expand human intelligence. Instead of having 100 trillion connections, we could have 200 trillion or 100 trillion times 1,000 and actually think bigger thoughts, download knowledge. There's a lot of implications.
You take me to a very particular place. As I was thinking about this conversation, looking forward to this morning, I had read The Age of Spiritual Machines, and I thought, you know, if somebody just downloaded that into my brain, since you had me thinking about it, would I know what I know by virtue of sitting there and struggling with these ideas and having to make something come clear and going back and writing something down and doing this underline? Would I, just by a data dump, would I really know what you're saying?
Well, let's examine that situation. If we take my knowledge of a subject like French, which actually is not that extensive, but
so it's a small subject.
But let's suppose I knew French. Where is that knowledge? It's actually represented as a pattern of information. It's not in one place. It's distributed throughout a whole region of my brain that deals with language. But it is a pattern of neurotransmitter concentrations, interneuronal connections that can be represented as information. Now, I can't take that pattern and just download it to your brain, because we don't have quick downloading ports on that information. And that's actually one of the natural advantages of machine intelligence. Machines can share their knowledge. We spent, for example, several years training one set of research computers to understand human speech, to create speech recognition software. And we had a system, and it had a certain accuracy level, and we actually exposed it to thousands of hours of recorded speech, and it made some mistakes, and we corrected it patiently. And over years, the system got better and better.
So you were a good parent.
Just like we were a parent teaching it a child. And these actually are using methods that have some analogies to the way the human brain works and that they're self-organizing and so forth. And ultimately, it was able to do a pretty good job, or at least a commercially acceptable job, of recognizing human speech. Now, if you want your personal computer to do the same task, you don't have to go through those years of training it and teaching it like a child. You can just load the evolved pattern that we created in our lab. It's called loading the software. So machines can instantly share their knowledge. Now, human beings can also share their knowledge, but not quickly by downloading. We do it through this very extensive, long, patient process of communication. We call it education. It takes 20 years to take a child and teach them some basic knowledge about our society and civilization and so on. But machines, once they learn something, can share their knowledge instantly. So ultimately, when we can expand our own biological intelligence through this intimate connection with non-biological forms of intelligence, some of which will be organized very similarly to the way our biological brains are, we'll be able to add a new type of thinking that is able to download knowledge. And this is decades away, but this is one of the implications of these developments.
Our guest is Ray Kurzweil, and we're going to let Bill Russell talk when we come back in just a moment. Forgive the interruption. We'll be back momentarily. Please stay tuned to The Paula Gordon Show.